Rachel Larvey, Reel 2. And your accommodation, you say you actually had rather more substantial than the refugees themselves.
Yes, very much. Our accommodation was actually in Sulaymaniyah town, so not up in the mountain, but down in the village, down in the valley. And we had a house, a brick-built house with glass at the windows, and facilities for water and electricity, but these obviously weren't in fact working because they were off all over the town, and so no heating and no hot water or no water of any kind. And it was a bit grim in that it was dark and cold and gloomy and depressing, but it was a brick-built house, it wasn't a plastic sheet, so of course I was very grateful for that. And I had in fact I had a US Army sleeping bag, a wonderful thing. I don't know quite how we'd got them, but we did. The US Army were around somewhere and they'd left them behind. So down filled warm sleeping bag, plus my own sleeping bag. So I slept inside two sleeping bags with tracksuit trousers, thick socks, my fleecy jacket, and I think a pair of thermal pajamas. I also at one time slept with a hat on because my head got so cold. I never ever succeeded in getting a warm nose at night. I remember my nose being cold. And a hot water bottle. So I think somehow we must have had, I think we had a little kerosene, no, we had a Prima stove, that's right. She boiled water inside our hot water bottle. So I was lucky. It made me realise though when we went out, I still had a cold nose with all that lot inside a brick-built house. How the people ever got warm inside their flimsy shelters. But when we went in to visit them, you would see that people would sleep all curled up together as one family for body warmth. And they would build a little fire inside, often inside their plastic shelter housings, with a hole in the top of the plastic shelter to let out the smoke. And then they would all curl around the fire and sleep together. I worried a bit, obviously, about the newborn babies getting cold. But people are amazing, aren't they, in that every shred of clothing they've got, they'll put on the baby and they'll go even colder themselves, as long as the baby stays warm. And what they do, actually, in Kurdistan is they swaddle their children, like Jesus was swaddled, I suppose, really tight, so that they can't move. And I guess that keeps them warm. I mean, there must be a thin layer of air to keep them warm under that, but they are very, very closely bound and tightly bound, even over their heads, because you do lose heat through your head a lot. And the babies didn't seem too badly off. In fact, it probably made them quite healthy, I should think, learning to live in quite a Spartan sort of atmosphere. Perhaps we overheat our babies.
Well, what sort of feeding system? You know, would it have been natural?
Yes, definitely. And that was one thing which we promoted very much, was breastfeeding. The Iraqi Kurdish women themselves were not particularly malnourished. There was food available, and so the women had enough food to eat, and therefore their milk production was plentiful. And that wasn't a difficult thing, actually. It was much harder teaching women in hamlets to breastfeed than teaching Kurdish women to breastfeed. Yes, they would breastfeed quite happily.
How did they relate to you? You know, would you have been the first Westerners that a lot of the people had met? Something.
Yes, I think so. I don't think me personally, because as I say, by the time I came, they'd already had the armies, the US Army had been there and others, and a lot of other aid workers had been in right at the beginning, whereas I got there some months perhaps after the disaster. So we were the first Westerners en masse. And generally, as I say, the Kurdish people were very grateful to us as individuals, although our respective governments they weren't quite so grateful to. They felt that a lot of Western governments were just paying lip service to assisting the Kurds, and they felt that they'd heard it all before throughout history. Yes, of course, we'll help the Kurdish people to have an independent and recognised Kurdistan, but it was just rhetoric. And that's sad, because I am British, and you know, people are saying that your country, your government doesn't do what it tells us it's going to do. And that's when you just have to say, look, I don't represent my country, I'm me, and I care, and that's why I've come. And you can only help on a one-to-one basis. And that's what I've found continually throughout my career as a relief worker.
That a one-to-one relationship is the thing. Yeah.
Yes.
How about men and women? Was there any difference, you know, in the way they responded to you?
Oh, very much indeed, yes. That was quite an eye-opener for me, going into a society where women are not respected or treated on the same way as men at all. For a start, I drove a car. They were horrified to see me driving not just a car, but a four-wheel drive Land Rover. And I would go alone into the souk, into the market, and got an awful lot of stares. I mean, partly I'm fair-ish and a white Western woman who would probably get stared at anyway. But it was quite shocking just to be shopping alone, and again with your head uncovered and all sorts of things. I didn't wear revealing clothing, certainly not at minus 20 degrees. But at my head, maybe I had a hat on, but it certainly didn't cover me like a veil would or what they would wear. Sad in a way that you perhaps are shocking people, but you've got to be practical and you've got to get on and you've got to work, and it's practical to drive. If you drive, you have to drive yourself. I did have one awkward situation where apparently one of our local staff wanted to marry me, to which I was completely oblivious. And he had decided that I would be a good wife for his family, and the family had discussed it amongst themselves and decided that yes, this would be a good person. And the next thing I knew, I was invited home, and his mother sat next to me and slapped me on the knee and welcomed me into the family as a prospective daughter-in-law. I was then advised by this chap's uncle that the family were weighing me up and thinking that I would be a good influence on him. So I hastily stopped talking to him. It seems a bit rude and a bit hard, but I realised that perhaps I've just been too open and friendly, as I generally am with everybody. So it was a lesson I learnt. Walking out in the street alone was a bit of a no-no too. Really, you should be accompanied. I quite like sporting activities, so I thought I would go jogging. That was a bit of a no-no too, really. I was stared at a lot. Bit unwise, probably.
Were you given any sort of advice before you went about this, you know, living in a society like that?
I think perhaps I was a bit too naive. I was given general advice. You know, you do realise it's a Muslim society, don't you, as well, and plus one that has not been very open to what does happen in the Western world, and so you need to be respectful of that. And perhaps I didn't take that to heart enough. I don't think I committed anything that was too grossly indecent, but perhaps I wasn't overly sensitive, and maybe I would be more so now. Perhaps I was just thinking of my own self and independence. And I think partly I like to flaunt the fact that I can do this. Of course I can drive. For heaven's sake, I don't need a man to drive me. There's perhaps a part of that in me, yeah.
How did the various organisations cooperate in this situation? You know, obviously you were dealing mainly with women, I imagine, weren't you? And, you know, with your training programme. But did you get a sense of how the different organisations were relating to each other?
Yes. UNHCR was the organisation under which everybody else worked. And they organised quite well different organisations to be responsible for different areas of relief work. So as I say, we were given the task of coordinating the traditional birth attendants and their training. Others, like Oxfam, were helping to provide clean water. Others providing food. The Red Cross was one. And things went quite smoothly. We'd have regular coordination and planning meetings with UNHCR to assess how things were going and how perhaps we should change our programmes, and also to have security briefings and updates on the political situation so that we all knew where we stood and how to react. So there was quite a good relationship there, in fact, better than in other places that I've worked, worse than in others. And certainly as a social setup, very good. There were a lot of parties and evening gatherings where all the organisations intermingled and met. But there were probably only about 70 expatriates in Sulaymaniyah. So you soon got to know them all quite well. It was always the same people at the same parties. So it was a bit of a same thing every week, every night. But it was quite jolly. It was quite a good atmosphere. And everybody was in good spirits, and everybody really wanted to pull together and work together after all we'd all come to the same situation.
Well, what were the dangers while you were there? You know, one hears of sort of air activity, that Saddam was allowed to, am I right in thinking that there were certain flights allowed?
Yes, that's right. The dangers to us were Iraqi extremists infiltrating into this part of Kurdistan and acting as spies, and they didn't like the Western aid that was coming into the Kurdish refugees, obviously. I mean, they wanted to keep secret what was going on. They didn't like journalists, they didn't like the military, they didn't like us. And there were threats against international humanitarian workers. Car bombs was the main one. I do remember two car bombs. In fact, nobody was injured in either, because the cars were empty when they went off. But we had to learn to check underneath our vehicles before we got in them every time for any suspicious packages perhaps placed underneath. We also had to check inside the exhaust pipe at the back. I guess that must have been another place where they would poke something. And the guys in our team actually constructed and welded some little metal spikes, spokes, whatever, to go across the exhaust pipe so the exhaust fumes could come out, but nothing could actually be poked inside, like a sort of grid. And so that was one of our preventative measures. I have to confess, sometimes I didn't remember to look underneath the car, and I'd turn the engine on and then think, oh, I was meant to look under the car, but this time it was all right. As I've gone on in relief work, I've got better at things like that. Another thing was going out jogging was a bit stupid. I had to stop that soon. Going out for walks, a lot of the area was heavily mined. It looked so beautiful in this miles and miles of innocent, beautiful, pristine snow. And sometimes I just think it would be wonderful to just go off and walk in. But heavily mined, and you couldn't possibly go straying further off the road. Again, streams, as the snow melted, as the spring came on, and the snow melted, and the streams would gush down, and often they would apparently be bringing mines which had been in the snow downstream with them. So never go bathing in the water. Easy for us to be told, and easy not to do it, but to tell Kurdish children not to go out playing, it's terribly difficult. And I never saw so many children with arms and legs and feet and hands blown off, and dogs as well. Never seen so many three-legged dogs as I saw in Kurdistan because of the mines. And it's the children and the dogs that are most vulnerable, because you can't tell children not to play there. They just don't understand. And they'll see, some of the mines can look so innocent. They go to pick it up, they think it's something shiny or so on. And there are so many different types of mine designed to blow off at different levels and create different injuries, and appalling injuries. Injuries that are designed often to maim and not to kill, which I think is despicable, really.
Was there much fear within the Kurdish population that you could gauge, you know, about Saddam and what he might do?
Absolutely. They were terrified. Terrified. They were terrified that we would all leave, which in fact in the end we did, that the Western world would no longer be aware of what was going on, because what was going on had suddenly been brought to our attention. And they just kept saying, at last, you've realised, at last you know what's happening. But this isn't new. This has been going on for 15 years or more. It just seemed incredible to them that nobody had done anything about it until now. And their fears were, well, perhaps grounded, really, in that they would be forgotten again, that we were all there for such a short time, and that once we'd gone, Saddam would turn them all into piles of bones, which was what they'd been threatened. just as their houses were piles of rubble, the Kurdish people would be left like that. So there was great fear, great fear. They all talked incessantly about massacres that had happened in the past, one of which was the village or town of Halabja. Now, I think that was the place where everybody was gassed with poison gas, and women, children, families, men, everybody was just found lying in a heap, completely overcome by fumes and died. And there were, when I was there, there was the anniversary of the massacre at Halabja, and there were people wailing and weeping in the street at the memory of it. They reenacted it in their play, and the children in the school were all taught about it. They all know about their history, the Kurdish people, and this is so important to them. They have to know what a struggle they've got and what a struggle their lives have been and will continue to be. And so it's passed down from generation to generation through word of mouth, through stories, through drama groups, through reenactments in plays, through songs, through every possible means, so that everybody knows. And that obviously is recounted to us. So as aid workers there, we soon learn to identify and listen to the struggles of the people. And I was amazed, really, how little I knew already, because I'm not the sort of person who doesn't read the papers. I do, and as I say, I'm the sort of person who's always been quite interested in what's going on in the world. And yet I don't think I'd really heard of Halabja. I think I'd heard vague, small reports about things happening in Kurdistan that had happened by the Iraqis. But Halabja didn't particularly ring a bell as the name of a place. It wasn't like I've heard of Abafan, I've heard of things that happened in our own country. It obviously wouldn't have made front page news. And there were so many other things that we had never heard of even at all that had just gone on. And not one single family didn't have some story to report about a family member who had been thrown into jail and never seen or heard of again. So it was it's a very, very personal tragedy to all the Kurds.
How did you communicate?
I was very lucky in that I had a translator called Chiman, who spoke perfectly good English. In fact, she'd been an English student at university in Sulaymaniyah, and she came with me absolutely everywhere. She was a wonderful girl. Some people do speak English. Most of the educated people that I had to deal with, the professors in the hospital, the people in the governmental department, spoke some English. We're very lucky, aren't we, that English is such a well-spoken, round-the-world language, easy to communicate with officials. But with the ordinary people, I had to speak through Chiman.
So how long were you there altogether in this area in Kurdistan?
Well, in fact, only 3 months, as I say. It was 3 months between January and April.
How do you think the situation altered during the 3 months, insofar as your own work was concerned? You know, were you gaining satisfaction that everything was moving forward with your
Yes, absolutely. And I seem to keep talking about the weather, but it does tie in with the weather, because the weather made things so much easier when the snow melted, and suddenly we could drive from Sulaymaniyah up into the mountains, you know, in an hour and a half instead of 4 or 5 hours. And also that similarly the people in the mountains were able to come down much more easily, and people who'd been in the mountains and had to have their babies up there could then come down and have them in the hospital. And also the program of training these courses got off the ground, and they started to organize themselves together, and they were able to come instead of being cut off by the snow. And generally communications and transportation was so much easier. Plus things always do look better, don't they, when it gets warmer and the sun's shining. And so I was greatly encouraged by the improvement and how things seemed to be getting themselves into a well-organized situation in terms of our program. For the refugees, again, it was slightly warmer, and so not so difficult to live out under your plastic sheeting, but they were no nearer going back and rebuilding their villages.
And wasn't any sort of warm clothing sent during the time you were there for the refugees?
Yes, UNHCR were providing clothes, and so people did gradually get thicker coats and shoes and socks and so on. But as in any situation, it is very difficult to distribute these things fairly and evenly. And, you know, all too often things would go to the people at the top and not always to the people at the bottom who really need them. And again, in the quantity in which they were needed and the speed at which these things were needed, there's obviously always a delay, a time delay. We also saw instances of very well-meaning but misplaced aid. I remember two instances. One, a truckload or several truckloads of shoes, loose shoes. So you might find one, but where do you find the other one to it? Just chucked in the back of a truck. But also some of the shoes were high-heeled strappy sandals. Hardly appropriate. Probably very well-meaningly given, but not appropriate. And that had cost money to be sent out, transported over Europe. And another was a whole batch of broken sewing machines. Now, sewing machines, great. I mean, they could have been used, but broken ones, not so great. When there's nobody to repair them and no spare parts. So you did see some misplaced aid. I had great admiration for the work of the Red Cross in Kurdistan, and this perhaps gave me my first impressions of the Red Cross. And I was impressed how in Kurdistan they had built themselves shelters to live in as a team up in the mountains. Now, as I say, we lived in Sulaymaniyah in the town because it was warmer and we had a house. They lived in the mountains with the refugees. Okay, they didn't live in plastic sheltering houses. They built warm houses with fires. They had generators so they could have their own heating and cooking and lighting. They had a snooker table. They had wine, beer, and they had saunas. I remember the saunas in particular. Now, this might seem quite decadent, but actually what it meant was that the Red Cross team could come home at the end of a grueling day and really relax and unwind and be well fed and well entertained and rested and relaxed and sleep well, get enough energy to go out for the next day of perhaps trudging through the snow for 14 hours, delivering food parcels to isolated villages, people who were totally cut off. And that's what really impressed me. Okay, they lived well, but they really worked hard. And the rest of us had to work less, because at the end of the day we had to spend several hours driving back to our homes. And some days we actually couldn't even make it all the way into the mountains because the snow was so bad and we couldn't journey. So we had wasted days in town, whereas they were always there. Okay, the Red Cross has got a lot of money and it has its own planes and it can fly these things in. And there are a lot of questions you can ask about the use of money in aid. But I saw it well invested, I think, there, so that they were able to work extremely hard.
Did all the organisations come under one sort of umbrella group?
All except the Red Cross. UNHCR coordinated the work of all the other NGOs under the UNHCR umbrella. The Red Cross is completely separate. It has to be by its very mandate. It has to be totally independent and impartial. And I was to discover more about that later when I worked for the Red Cross. But it is totally separate from the UN and from any of the other UN-related agencies. They work with them and they will cooperate with them, but will not be seen to be a part of them. And that's right.
So why did you leave after 3 months? You know, was it that your job was seen to be finished?
Not at all. My job was not finished. But I think it was able to hand over to the Kurdish authorities, the Minister of Health and the minions under her, could maintain it as it was. They didn't really need us not to do the job. They wanted us to stay, I think, because we were sort of some kind of protection. All the time we were there, the aid agencies, that is, the world was there. The world was looking at them. They had a voice. And they were terrified that when we left, Saddam would be able to come in and walk over them again. But our mandate ran out, and sadly, that's what happened to many of the agencies and to UNHCR. And they couldn't stay because the agreement was only for a certain period of time. So I had to leave when our time was up. And I have to say, I don't know very much more about what is going on in Kurdistan, because my life has moved on. I've gone to do other things. I do think about it. Perhaps I'm not concerned enough because my work has been elsewhere now. But we don't hear. We just don't know what's happening anymore. That's very sad.
Yes, how did you feel when you left, Julia? Was it with a lot of regret?
With a lot of tears, yes. I think it is a very remote part of the world, so not exactly an easy one to just nip back to and see how all my chums are. Although I'd love to. I'd absolutely love to. And I hope one day I'll go back to Kurdistan. I'd love to see Kurdistan as a real Kurdistan. The people are very different from the Iraqi people. And it's a place that will always be very much on my heart. Yeah.
Had you made friends with them? You know, you were saying about the difficulties with single young men, but you know, had you made relationships with various Kurds while you were there?
Yes, with Chiman in particular, and with a friend of Chiman's who also came to work for our team as a translator called Shireen. I think I had my fingers burnt a bit with this chap who wanted to marry me, and I soon realised that you can't have relationships with men as you can have relationships with men here. I have men and women friends, no problem. There, I was too open, too friendly, very unwise. With Chiman and Shireen, I think I got closer and closer as time wore on. Chiman had an offer of marriage from a Kurd living in Canada who she didn't know, and this is apparently quite common. Kurds who are now out in the Western world help their family by marrying a girl still in Kurdistan and bring her out to freedom. But Chiman wasn't your average Kurdish girl. She, although she was only 23, she had a mature head on her shoulders, and she said, "I don't know this guy. How can I possibly marry him? I don't love him. I don't know him. Yes, of course, he offers me the chance of freedom and a new life in Canada. And for someone as bright and educated and speaking English as she was, that would be a great offer." But she said, "How can I leave my family, my mother, my brothers, my sisters, my father? They need me. They need my income." And so the last I heard of it, I don't think she was going to go.
Did you gain any impression of the sort of organisation of the Kurds? You know, what was that like?
Very sad, really. The Kurds themselves are so split into different factions that I knew of at least 8 different political parties amongst the Kurds who said they were the one true leadership that all Kurds should be following. And until they unite in their struggle against the Iraqi government and the other governments around there who are anti them, they will never, never have a united people. And that was one of the saddest things. Different political rallies from different political groups, and they were all too busy fighting themselves to really face the enemy from without.
So, having gone through that experience, you know, what were your plans after that? After the Kurds,
I knew that this was the sort of work I wanted to stay in. I had absolutely loved the experience, the people, and the work. And I had no desires to go back to being a community midwife working in Tahammut. I don't think I could have either. It had changed me too much. I couldn't just come back and do the same thing as before. So my mother actually suggested I join the Red Cross, and it was good that she did, because as I say, I'd had the experiences of the Red Cross that I'd had in Kurdistan and been impressed with them. I think I thought, oh, it's terribly difficult, the Red Cross won't have me, because it's well known to be quite a difficult organisation to get to work for, because it doesn't take anybody, and it's quite hard to get onto their books, as it were. Everybody wants to. So anyway, I wrote to them, and quite amazingly, they put me on their register. I think, in the light of the experiences I'd already got, it's a catch-22, this situation, this relief game, because nobody will send you overseas to work for them unless you've got experience. And how do you get experience unless somebody sends you? So I had been fortunate enough to get in to the relief work by the back door, perhaps through this experience in Kurdistan with Tear Fund, and the Red Cross put me on their registers on the strength of that. And almost immediately after getting on the Red Cross register, I was asked to go for a week's training course at the Red Cross training headquarters near Guildford. And that's where they train Red Cross delegates for overseas posts. And you learn about the Red Cross movement, about the principles of the Red Cross,